Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Hey there.
All right, we got the quick intro. We do not have a guest, so we will speed on through, get into some fun basketball talk, to pull the curtain back a little bit, as this episode is going to be released like October 1st. I had a mind that as we get into October, we start with some division previews. We get the real W/NBA mashup in terms of the content. Had it real cool. Had it scheduled out. One division per episode. We get done by the time the regular season starts, etc. And then the Minnesota Timberwolves and the New York Knicks and also the Charlotte Hornets. So I guess we're getting more info on that front. Decided to go with a blockbuster to kind of throw all of that over the top rope. So instead of a division preview today on the NBA side, and naturally we have playoff talk to get to on the W side, we have a big trade to talk through that is on the precipice of being official. It's supposed to be a thing from ESPN's Ramona Shelburne, still working through some details, but that deal should be done at some point this week. But the foundation of the deal is Karl Anthony Towns going to the New York Knicks, Julius Randle, Dante DiVincenzo, Kata Bates-Jop going to the Minnesota Timberwolves, salary filler and salary matching things heading to the Charlotte Hornets. Just Steve, started with you. Like, what was your initial reaction to this one? Because it certainly caught me off guard when it came through the pipeline.
Shock. I don't think anyone expected a Friday night deal in September. Had to hit refresh about 2 to 3 times to make sure it was real. Wasn't an easy one to process. But if you look in the larger portion of it, the trade market is real. And so we've seen these teams extend and keep their talent. And if you're trying to acquire talent or bolster your team or bolster a hole, trades feel like it's where it's really at. Mm-hmm. I think not only just like the late nature of the trade, but also there's just a lot of financial implications that take a little bit to try and figure out why they did what they did. But then you read, oh, they saved how much on the luxury tax bill? Okay, that makes a little bit of sense. I get that. On the court wise, I think biggest thing for New York was working to shore up what are they going to do with the five this year? Isaiah Hartenstein is in Oklahoma City Thunder. Mitchell Robinson is still out for what, at least the first 2 months, they said. Mm-hmm. And so you're basically looking at a combination of Julius Randle, Precious Achiuwa, and Jericho Sims. And Tibbs has not really wanted to play Julius Randle at the five. I distinctly remember when he did it against Brooklyn last year, and Julius Randle was at the level, showed, didn't end well for the Knicks. And shortly thereafter, they put a big back in. So looking at that combination, and now it just turns into LOL Cat, is a little interesting. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest thing is Karl-Anthony Towns. I like the fit for him with the Knicks offensively. Obviously, he can space the floor. Really good in pick and roll. He can pick and pop. You can post him. You can use him at the elbow to attack or dribble handoffs with Jalen Brunson, Mikal Bridges, OG Anunoby. So you kind of have that wave offensively with that combination he brings. Mm-hmm. I think something that sometimes people forget about Cat and his rise is how good he was at the five offensively. And that blend that he brings to the table really puts pressure on teams, and he can really put pressure and punish some fives. So, you know, in the post, driving from the elbow, from the perimeter, you get the pick and pop for three, you get the drive and the close out to finish or kick. You feel a lot more of that weight at the five. As opposed to when teams were just able to say, hey, you're spaced, or hey, we'll switch, we're fine. It puts a little bit of trickery on it. Now, teams could get, it could be interesting. Maybe they put a five on OG Anunoby. We'll see how that plays out, but it'll be intriguing. I do think him being at the five changes the math in the Eastern Conference a little bit. I'll be interested to see how creative Tibbs gets with it. If he runs them off some screens, runs them off some staggers, you know, horns with a flare. I'm probably more intrigued, not just like by Brunson screening for him on ball, but some of the off ball actions they can use those two together with, mm-hmm. especially with Brunson as a screener. So that should be very fun. That was my initial deal there. I am intrigued to see, does he take some of what he's learned at the four and integrate that? Will the Knicks have better spacing? Can he mix in some of those cuts? Can he mix in some of those drives when spaced? You know, you could get the best of both worlds.
I like that. Like, I think outside of the initial shock, because I was, you know, I'm based in North Carolina, so I was dealing with some of the effects of the storm. So, like, internet power and all the good stuff was just kind of funny for me on Friday. And so I was about an hour or so late to the initial tweet that the deal was happening. And naturally, I was just like, wait, huh? Why is this happening now? more than anything, because I think we talked a little bit about the Timberwolves as their season officially ended, kind of doing the what comes next type B, what are you looking for, et cetera. And I remember making a comment about, or just kind of thinking through, will they keep this core together for another year? Because I knew at some point, just based on the salaries, Ant's deal kicking in, Jaden McDaniels kicking in, stuff like that, at some point there would be a piece of the core that would be moved. And I just kind of generally wondered who that would be. Would that be Cat? Would it be Gobert? What would they do in the front court? And when would it be? Would they pull the trigger this summer, this offseason, considering the playoff success that they had? Do they push it to the trade deadline? Do they push it to next offseason? I just didn't know. So for them to pull this right before, you know, recording on a Monday, so like media days are here now, to pull it now just seems really interesting, or being on the verge of pulling it now seems interesting on that front. As far as the on-court fit, To your point, I am very excited to see Cat at the five full time, or not, maybe not even full time, but like more than we get to see it in Minnesota. Like, I think the volume of those minutes are going to be a little bit higher, and him being able to play with a pick and roll partner that is different stylistically than what Anthony Edwards wanted to do. Like, I do wonder like how quickly those two are going to gel together when they're in action. In terms of the pick and roll, I love the point that you made about being able to use them off ball, having Brunson screen for him. Having Cat screen for Brunson, what can you get into with an empty side? I think it's going to be really fun. As far as Cat defensively goes, like, Tibbs has experience with Karl Anthony Towns. And so in terms of what he's going to be asked to do and just what the overall infrastructure is going to be for him, like, I don't know if it's going to be a major adjustment for him. Like, I think we've talked about throughout the history of the pod, like, I feel like Cat is at his best when he's at the level versus him being at a drop or something like that. Tibbs played Mitchell Robinson at the level a bunch before he got hurt last year, would have him drop back, but got him up there. There was a level of activity there. And again, with Cat already having the experience playing under Tibbs, like, I don't think that's going to be a super difficult transition for him to make. And then being able to play with rangy defenders, OG Anunoby, Mikal Bridges is going to be back. Josh Hart when he's in the lineup with those guys. Like, I think there's going to be an element of Cat being used in his optimal scheme and a lot of high-level defenders behind him to kind of help him out and cover space and cover ground. And so I am intrigued by what that's going to look like. The spacing is certainly going to help, going back to the offensive side. We know Cat is one of the best three-point shooting bigs that the league has ever seen. The Knicks could certainly use more spacing to help give Jalen Brunson more room to operate, adding Mikal Bridges in, giving him more room to operate with. I think to the graphic from, I think, Todd Whitehead of Synergy, a crumpled jumper on Twitter, and he posted a graphic about middle of August with, it was kind of showcasing how far out on average an opposing team center was out on the perimeter, or how close they were to the rim when the shot attempt went up. The Boston Celtics, naturally, they were first in that metric. The New York Knicks, dead last in that metric. They were super close to the basket. Or face bigs being super close to the basket. Just the spacing was kind of crumpled there, or kind of cramped there. And so adding Cat should change that dynamic, should make things a little bit easier for the Knicks to generate good looks on the offensive end. So I like it from that standpoint. It does kind of box them in to a degree, just because you are adding in the Cat salary. And so this is a move that's going to have to hit pretty immediately, I feel like. But I think the seeds are there. Like, I think they'll be able to defend well enough with him on the floor. Offensively, he's going to help them out quite a bit. And so I like the fit from the New York side.
I think one of the things you say, it boxes the Knicks in. The Knicks have been pedaled to the metal. This is our time. This is our window. It's time now. You don't go get Bridges and get Cat if you don't think your time is now. I think what becomes interesting is, are these moves specifically for Boston, or are these moves to be the best team you can be? And can you find a level of versatility throughout this season? I think as good as that five is, and as many pieces you can mix in, that's kind of your five. And you're going to have to navigate the playoffs and find a level of lineup versatility and scheme versatility. I think defensively, I know people have questions about that end of the floor. And I saw someone in my mentions brought up the Tibbs Wolves defensive rating numbers when Cat was there, which, I mean, again, the Wolves were like 13th in defensive rating in 21-22 with Cat as a five. It's a thing that can work. I think for the Knicks, all Cat has to do his job defensively. Mm-hmm. And so I have had some concerns about Cat in a drop and giving too much space to guards. I am some of the scheme versatility can sometimes pop my eye. Looking back at some of the tape this morning, you saw Minnesota did try and work to have him not just at the level, but, you know, hedge out, show and recover, have him at the level and drop back. So attempt to have him do different things. I think that, to your point, one of the biggest things is having screen navigators like OG Anunoby and Josh Hart and Mikal Bridges. That should help. But having them as weak side defenders should also help take pressure off of him, specifically in the scheme. Mm-hmm. But I think the biggest thing is they're going to have to work to figure out what's going to be the best thing for them to maximize it so they can have a little bit of switchability to a degree to navigate the playoffs. I think when Cat was at the four, he learned to get better at it defensively. And it'll be interesting. Obviously, Mitchell Robinson returned. They may have double big lineups. There were still ways you could get to him. You could put him in movement. You could make him navigate screens. The rotations were better last year, but you could force him to make decisions in space. I do think having more of that pure at the 5 minutes should help him from that respect. My mind is stuck on Isaiah Hartenstein and the defensive effort he gave last year. That surprised me. Some people may have thought he always had it in him, but I didn't know he could do that consistently. So I kind of give the Knicks a little bit of the benefit of the doubt there. But we'll see how that kind of blends together. Because if you're ready for one team and you face another, what's that going to look like? I also don't think it changes much of the challenges the Knicks would have had. I mean, if you go back to that playoff series, Maxey and Embiid and pick and roll was something that they had to try and figure out. It's not going to change. Like, you're still going to have to deal with some of these things. Brunson's still going to be involved in actions. Like, you kind of have to navigate and find your way. So I kind of get trying to maximize what you can offensively and get the most out of it.
Okay. I'll toss you a quick lineup question, because as you mentioned earlier, like, Mitchell Robinson is currently out. But assuming that, one, he gets healthy and he's not moved by the time the playoffs come around, like, how often do you think Tibbs would want to start with Cat and Mitchell Robinson together? Or do you think that's just going to be a full-on staggering deal for those two?
I would assume staggering.
Okay.
I mean, I think we would get some minutes of it, but I think it will look closer to what we saw last playoff run before the injury.
I was curious. That was one of my early thoughts as I actually had some time to digest it on the Saturday. It's like, I wonder if they start that way when they're healthy and kind of juice the bench. If you're going to go with, again, Jalen Brunson, Mikal Bridges, OG, Cat, and Mitchell Robinson, if you really want to size up, depending on who you're playing. Like, I don't know if you do that against Boston in particular, but in general, like, that's an avenue that's available to them. Now you have Deuce off the bench, you have Josh Hart off the bench, and you still have the ability to kind of miss and match. I was kind of wondering, would Tibbs be willing to press that button, or do you just go with Cat at the five, stick with that, maximize your spacing offensively, and believe that you can be workable enough defensively to make that work? So I'm curious about that part. The other thing I was going to ask, in relation to some of the things that Cat may see, you made the point about, does some of the lessons from Cat at the four kind of transfer to the Knicks this year? I'm trying to figure out the best way to phrase it. Like, how much do you think the coverage changes against him in this Knicks context?
Well, he's more likely to be guarded by fives than straight out wings, right?
I would imagine so. You did float out like, hey, do you put a big on OG and kind of tinker with stuff theirs?
I mean, so they could put a big on OG, put a wing on Cat, turn into a switch. And then you have some of the same question marks. But then you can also use OG as a screener. So there's back and forth play that could happen there. Mm-hmm. I think it changes from the aspect that if he's facing centers, there's more traditional coverages that he'll face. Unless there are teams, I don't know how many East teams are willing to switch their center onto Jalen Brunson time and time again, at least this version.
Yeah.
So now that opens up the ability to mix in the pop, mix in the roll, and not have it just be an automatic switch right from the jump. I think there will be teams that will do it. I think Boston's a team that's well-equipped to do it. I wouldn't be surprised if Cleveland was a team that tinkered with it. But I don't know if it's going to be as copy-paste game plan as it turned out to be when he was at the four in the Western Conference.
Okay. I'd imagine Miami would also try to sprinkle that in if they could, because I don't think there's a player in the league they're not comfortable switching Bam on at this point. But, okay, I want to take the temperature on that front. Did you have
it? The trick is, who is guarding Jalen Brunson?
yeah, which, you know, yeah, it's Monday, so media day things are happening. Not sure who the starting five is going to be for Miami. Eric Spoelstra did make a comment about wanting to see more of Rozier, Hero, Butler, and Bam together. So, like, I, you know, trying to figure out the fifth there. Jovic started, had Haywood, Highsmith, like that get interesting. I would imagine that comment is just the, hey, I want these guys to be healthy so I can get a sample, more than this is our starting four to five or whatever. But yeah, like if they have Haywood in there, I would imagine it's Haywood, Highsmith, you take on the Brunson matchup. You have Bam on Cat. That could be a more natural switch for Miami, at least conceptually. Not saying that's going to work 100% of the time, but there's some, they have some avenues to like get to that look if they want to get to that look.
Oh yeah, man. Media day. Yeah. This is the best team I ever played for. I'm so happy to be with such a talented group. We're really focused and locked in on a championship. Do I know who I'm starting? No, we're going to let it play out. I think we got a really great group. High optimism. Willing to do anything to win. I'm pretty healthy now. Did I cover all the bases? I got at least six of them.
Yes. I have lost X pounds. This is the best. I'm in the best shape of my life. I have gained 15 pounds of muscle. I'm in the best shape of my life. Those would be the other two that you had to the media day bingo card. It's the best offseason I've had. I'm really focused in on insert skill here. But yeah, beyond that, did you have any other Knicks thoughts before we move?
It will be interesting to see who gets the opportunities and what bench lineup, what the bench turns into. Obviously, they can stagger. Obviously, they will stagger. I mean, I would assume you got McBride, you got Campaign, you got Precious. That gets you to eight. Got a bunch of wings, got to mix and match. Mm-hmm. Be interesting to see how much they miss the shot making of Dante DiVincenzo. But yeah, I get it.
Okay. And for the Wolves side, adding Julius Randle, adding Dante DiVincenzo, KBD also going to the Wolves, as I, again, very high on the KBD to Phoenix signing last year. That signing did not pop the way that I thought it would. But back in the familiar homes, we'll see what his role looks like there. What are some of your initial thoughts on the Julius Randle fit in Minnesota?
I think for some folks, they're pointing at Karl Anthony Towns, they're pointing at Julius Randle, and now how you feel about this trade is how you feel about Julius Randle to a degree, which I understand. But at the same time, I think that there needs to be a level of hold on a minute player that we add to some of this. Mm-hmm. I think people forget Julius Randle was an all-star last year. And for a good chunk of the season, he was leading the Knicks in assists. I mean, it was only 46 games, but he averaged, what, 24 points, 9.2 rebounds, 5 assists? The only players that do 29-5 were Jokic, Giannis, Embiid, Luka, Şengün, and Julius Randle. That's it. That's the list. It's pretty good. Mm-hmm. I have my questions, but I think it's easy to kind of forget some of the improvements that he had made last year when he was making quicker decisions, when he was driving the basketball, putting his head down. The passing had stood out as far as being able to skip it to the corner, drive and kick when defenses came in and helped. Mm-hmm. He obviously made the tough shots, depending on your volume or love for those. I can understand whether you like him or not. But I think some of the best moments were get a rebound. He's pushing in transition, initiating the offense, get to a handoff. Don't have anything. Let me get you for another screen. Get to another handoff. Go to the other side. Drive and kick from the perimeter. Those type of plays I thought were pretty good. In my mind, one of the things that Cat had to deal with a lot was switches. And if you're going to switch wings onto Julius Randle, he's going to look to attack. And if you show help or show a double, he's going to be able to make those passes. You know, my mind goes to like Miami games where he would get a switch. They double on the catch, or they play Milwaukee, switch Beasley on them. He stops right at the top, says, I'm going to drive. Help comes. And he finds Hartenstein near the basket and scores. I think how you use them is important. You know, I think a lot of people think about the loud misses. They think about the elbow touches, the tween hezzy. I get it. I thought the Knicks tapped into a lot of good stuff with Julius Randle last year, having guards screened for him and running inverted pick and roll and letting him get downhill that way, trying to force some switches, trying to force some help, having Mitchell Robinson set screens for him at times and letting him get downhill and throw lobs. It's apparently, you know, that's something you could run with Rudy Gobert, hypothetically. Using him in dribble handoffs, you know, to get him downhill in transition. I think that's good. For better or worse, he's used to playing the four. And with the creativity of Chris Finch, I think there's some things they can tap into to make it work with Julius Randle. Mm-hmm. I think you had to figure a lot of things out with Cat and Rudy. there will be an adjustment period for Randall in Minnesota, but the hierarchy is there. The talent is there. You know what you want to run. Mm-hmm. Now we just need to get to it. And so I think that that portion of the program will be interesting. Like if it's just post-ups and elbow touches, which I don't think it will be, it gets interesting. But we saw the growth of Naz Reid. We know they know how to use bigs in creative ways. Mm-hmm. Julius Randle does have talent. I think there's more on the table than people realize. Like, I don't think Mike Conley is just going to throw it to him right at the elbow all the time. He's done that before, you know. I think they're pretty good. I think having Dante DiVincenzo, being able to add him as well, I mean, you'd be able to bring Dante and Nah off the bench. It's pretty fun on both ends of the floor. And now I think secretly you kind of open up some lineup optionality to a degree to where we can close different players. We can try and mix and match, do different things. So I'm intrigued by it. I think it's a lot more interesting than people may be giving it credit to on first look.
Okay. Like, I think, I guess just zooming out with the trade at large, like the boring stuff and the boring yet important stuff is what you allude to up top. Like, there is a financial element to this that makes sense for Minnesota's bookkeeping moving forward. And so, like, you can't completely erase that portion of the program for that trade and from that perspective. Getting a first-round pick, even though it's protected, like, I would imagine that conveys in 26, if not 27. So, like, you do have that back and forth. So, anyway, that portion is important. To the on-court portion with Julius Randle, I find that I like the fit. I guess similar to you, I like the fit more than other people did, at least based on some of the reactions that I was able to see over the weekend. Because I do think if one of your questions about the Minnesota Timberwolves was, hey, what happens when teams switch against them? Can you generate fruitful offense for yourself? Having someone like Julius Randle, who is just used to, for lack of a better word, just used to bullying people and getting to his spots, especially if they're smaller defenders, that helps. And to your point about the usage and just in general, the kind of help that he saw, like the assist number speaks for itself, it's over five again. But there was, at least for me, like some real growth in terms of not just making the right pass, but what type of pass he's making, when he's doing it, what the placement on those passes look like and things like that. And with Randle being used to being a four and coming from the New York context in particular, I understand the hand-wringing about spacing, and I do think there's room for improvement there for Minnesota overall. Randle's kind of used to operating at a phone booth to a degree. So, like, I don't think he's being moved to, like, he's being moved to a worse context, and now he has to reorient himself about how he's going to get to looks and things like that, and he just looks worse. Like, he's already kind of used to catch, survey, take a couple dribbles, I can just kind of get to the shot that I want to get to, or get all the way to the rim and get to the free throw line. I don't think that part changes. And as you mentioned, already having some experience with, again, playing alongside number five, but getting downhill, being able to slip those passes in or slip those lobs in, there is some ready-made chemistry that could be built there with Rudy. Defensively is also where my brow kind of raises, because as Minnesota tried to find some scheme versatility, again, you spoke to that with Kat, it did feel like there were some pockets where Minnesota wanted to switch more and maybe didn't feel as comfortable with doing so. I feel like switching is probably Julius Randle's best coverage, just on a base level. Not that he is going to be confused with like Bam Adebayo, but we have seen engaged Julius Randle throughout his Knicks career be pretty solid at holding his own. And so if you feel like we can just have Randle at the level if you want, because we got Rudy back there, we got a bunch of length behind him, or, okay, now we can just switch a little bit more comfortably and flatten things out. That may take some strain off of other defenders if he can hold his own in that regard. So I'm curious to see, like, if Randle gets fully healthy and he's motivated, do you see a different level of scheme versatility for Minnesota? Is this a case of them strengthening a strength in an unconventional way? And then you add in the Dante DiVincenzo portion of the program, as he is a really good defender. He was one of the best high-volume shooters in basketball last year. And somehow perked up even more during the postseason as the Knicks dealt with injury after injury after injury. Like, you're adding a movement element. You're adding some secondary ball handling. To your point again, Steve, adding some lineup optionality there. Like, if you want, you know, if you're doing some regular season maintenance, if you want to say, hey, Mike, we got three games in 5 days. Hey, take this one. You can now size up in the starting lineup and go with Ant and Dante in your backcourt and still have Jaden, have Julius, have Rudy, And that's a lot of defense that you could throw at teams and still have an element of shooting on top of that. So I like, there are some fun things that you can get mix and match with on, in that regard. So like, I think overall, like I kind of like it for both teams. Like I think Cat is the obvious talent slash spacing play for New York, and he opened up some things. But Julius Randle, I think his ability to play make, his ability to drive and get downhill, get to the line. And again, if he's engaged and healthy, his ability to switch may open up some other avenues for Minnesota defensively. And you zoom out financially, you get a little bit more breathing room and a little bit more optionality moving forward as you try to build this thing around Anthony Edwards at the end of the day. So I am cool with it for Minnesota. Now, granted, games got to be played. I may come back in December like, man, I was too high on this. But at least first blush, I kind of like it for both sides. At the very least, it makes sense to me why both teams like it.
No, I mean, I think, again, it's both teams are trying to craft a vision. You're trying to find a way to compete. You're trying to make things, keep doors open. And I don't necessarily think the Minnesota Timberwolves got worse. I don't think the Knicks got worse. They may end up with worse records. So that'll be the, that'll be the fun. I mean, this is, it's the NBA. It's tough. I think the one thing, you bring up the Randle defense point, it is going to be interesting. None of what he's going to face is going to be new. I mean, he just played for Tibbs for X amount of years, but at the same time, in that conference, you're going to have to bring it every single night at a high level. And how do teams look to try and attack him? You know, is he going to be locked in rotation-wise to help out Rudy? How does that kind of figure itself out chemistry-wise to where they're able to kind of uplift that same defense? I think the reason why it raises my eyebrow is Minnesota needs that defense to be at a certain level to be the best version of themselves. And so we saw in year one of Cat and Rudy what happened as they were trying to figure that out. But year two, we saw when it was lights out, what that meant for them. If you kind of take a step backwards there, what does that look like in this particular season where the Western Conference is, you know, it's typically very dangerous, but there's a lot of good teams looking to climb up to where you were.
Oh, I think that's a good point. And to the overall size point, like you are quite literally getting smaller with Randle versus Cat at the four. And so what does that mean for the rebounding? And through the lens of the Denver matchup in particular, as Minnesota was able to knock them off in the postseason last year, how comfortable is Chris Finch going to like the cross-matching gambit that we saw last year? Where, hey, Cat, you take on Nikola Jokic, Rudy Gobert, we want you to roam off of Aaron Gordon. Like, can you get to that kind of cross? Do you feel comfortable getting to that with Julius Randle defending fives and letting Rudy roam around? Like, I don't have the answer to that. But I am curious to see, like, if he taps that button and if he does, like, what that's going to look like. Because I think if you're Minnesota, like, you're probably okay with losing two or three regular season wins if you feel like you're more playoff viable. And now you can now get to the conference finals again or get further. If you feel like Julius Randle's helped you solve some very specific questions on either end of the floor. If you can't get to that and the offense doesn't hit the way that you want to, that's a different conversation altogether. But as, again, just bouncing off of your general point, like the defense does have to get to a certain level. I believe Randle will help with their switching, but can they get to some of the cross-matching fun? I don't know. And if they can't, like how much of a hit is that? We'll see. And then also just as we get more details on what exactly Charlotte is getting, I in particular will have some Charlotte thoughts. We'll see if a Daquan Jeffries does some stuff. But these two teams are obviously the biggest part of this trade, at least for now. So we'll circle back when necessary. Did you have any closing thoughts on the deal or any closing questions?
Nah, let the games begin. Quite the way to kick off media day in the preseason.
Indeed, preseason basketball is here. That's kind of crazy. Time really flies when you're watching a whole bunch of hoop. But very quickly on the extension front, the Clippers and Terrence Mann agreeing to a 3-year, $47 million extension. Mann averaged 9 points, 3 boards, shaved under 2 assists in 25 minutes per game last season, 9-5-2 in the first round last year against Dallas. And the Pelicans and Jose Alvarado agreeing to a 2-year, $9 million extension, 7 points, 2 boards, 2 assists, and a steal in 18 minutes a game. Off the bench for Jose Alvarado. I think he finished sixth in sixth man of the year voting as well. So just a quick salute there. Did you have any thoughts on either one of those extensions?
No, I mean, I think it's, again, this kind of ties back into rewarding your talent, keeping your talent, paying your talent, and continuing to build forward with what you have. And if we need to pivot, we can pivot. And if not, no. I mean, Jose Alvarado, you saw the deal that he was on. I'm sure this is pretty big for him to be, have a little bit more security going forward and what he's done for New Orleans. Terrence Mann continuing to be a big part of the next phase for the Clippers. So it's more of a salute for me than anything else.
Okay, I got you. I'm right there. Like, I really enjoyed watching Terrence Mann just build himself into a reliable two-way piece for this Clippers group. And as they've now gone into a bit of a, not necessarily a full-blown transition period, but, you know, Paul George isn't there anymore. So whatever this new iteration of the team is going to look like, I know he's going to be an important piece of their success, whatever that success looks like this year. And with Jose Alvarado, I had to be reminded, like, went from, I think it was from undrafted to two-way to earning deal and now earning another deal for him. And like, my initial thought was like, I figured he would have gotten more based on like what the defense in particular looks like, how important the drives were, the playmaking is pop. There are still questions about the jumper, and then just kind of going back to what that first round was like for him against OKC and some of the coverage or lack thereof that he saw. I was like, okay, well, that might explain why the number wasn't as high as I thought it was going to be. But he has still turned himself into one of the best backup players in the NBA. And more specifically, certainly one of the best backup point guards in the league. So I'm with you. Quick salutes all around. No real, not to hang there too long. On the W news front, we do have a little bit of expansion news. The expansion draft for the Golden State Valkyries is going to be held on December 6th on ESPN. In terms of protecting rules, each team can protect up to 6 players that they have rights for. And then those other players will go into the expansion draft pool. Valkyries be able to draft the team from there. And so I am really excited to kind of put on the nerd cap and try to figure out which 6 players each team is going to try to protect. I'm sure there's going to be a future pod segment at some point, but we do have news on that front.
Well, hold on. I'll raise my hand real quick. Okay. As I'm doing some digging, right? Mm-hmm. It becomes very interesting because, as you mentioned, every team has a maximum of 6 protected players. They don't have to protect 6 if they don't want to.
That's also true.
The other kicker is the Valkyries will only be able to select 1 player from across the entire league who is eligible to become an unrestricted free agent following the 2024 season. Mm-hmm. So it could get funny.
Could get incredibly funny. And again, as I try to get a better handle on some of the like core rules in relation to the expansion draft, like, does that force some teams into some interesting core decisions? Like, okay, maybe we didn't expect to use this on you, but we still wanted to negotiate and try to bring you back. Are you now like, well, darn, if we don't do it, she may just be a Valkyrie. So now we kind of have to. So that part is going to be interesting to me. But it's September 30th right now. The draft is on December 6th. So I'm sure we'll get a lot more info and things to talk about on that front before we get to the expansion draft. On the award front, we got official word that Nafisa Collier has been named the Defensive Player of the Year. She received 36 of the 67 votes. Other players receiving votes, Asia Wilson getting 26. She finished second. Ezzy Mabigore with 3. Dejanay Carrington and Courtney Williams receiving the other 2 votes, 1 apiece for those 2.
Nafisa. Any thoughts on the Defensive Player of the Year voting, guys?
Not a surprise that Fee won, or at least for me, it wasn't a surprise that she won because she was really freaking good for a really freaking good defense and did a lot of important things on the ball and off the ball. Rebounded well. So, like, I don't think the award should be as controversial as some circles have made it. And even with that, like, she only had 10 more votes than Asia. So it wasn't like it was a runaway in that regard. So it still signifies a close race on that front. Like Ezzy getting some nods. Makes sense that Dejanay got one. Courtney Williams getting a Defensive Player of the Year vote was not something that I expected, to put it kindly. I have certainly seen better votes in my day. It was very funny to get like a, I end up tweeting out like, hey, like, what were you watching to give Court a Defensive Player of the Year vote? And a little bit later got the not too much with the laughing emoji from Courtney Williams herself. So that was a funny twist to add to my Sunday. But I don't get it. I don't get that one. Like, with all due respect to Courtney Williams, who did hold her own defensively this year, But she's defender number five within Minnesota's really good defensive starting lineup. And just conceptually, voting for, at best, the fifth best defender on a team as the best defender in the league just does not register for me at all. So that one just, I didn't quite understand that one. And I even did the thing, like it was partly petty on my part. I was like, okay, well, let me look at some of the under the hood numbers, look at some public stuff. Like, is there anything that you could even attempt to point to try to build out this case? And like the literal only thing that I could get to was the Lynx having, I think, a 92.5 defensive rating with Courtney Williams on the floor. And I think with Fee, it was like a 93 point. So she had like a slightly better on-court defensive rating than Fee. And I was like, that's literally the only thing that I could point to. And so if someone went to like Minnesota team page or however you could filter it on PvP stats and you saw Courtney Williams number one for Minnesota, that's like the only pathway that I could even think of. And even then, no. And then that also just brought me to my general thought, one that I've shared on this podcast many a times, both on the NBA side and on the W side, is that I just don't like award ballots being used as the let me give this player props piece. I know player X is going to win, so let me use my vote to highlight someone that hasn't been talked about enough. I don't like that conceptually because that's just not what the vote is supposed to represent. And considering how the voting pool is selected, like you're either a national voice or you are working at a local outlet, that means you quite literally in some way have a platform to like talk about the player that you want to give props to without using an official award ballot on it. So like I was not a fan of that one. I'll put it that way.
Did it make you as mad as when EDD got a vote in 2016?
Probably not. Like I probably not. No, like no. Though I had to go back and do some search on 2016 to see like what the pool was and all the good stuff. But I highly doubt that I would be more upset about that one than like she wasn't the best defensive guard on her team.
If I told you that EDD got as many votes as Tamika Catchings that year, would that make you upset?
Knowing who Tamika Catchings is, probably yes. Probably it sure would, because how we get there, like, now again, this is 2016, this is healthy EDD who was a darn good defender in her own right, so I don't want to be disrespectful, but like
I don't think I've heard that combination of words come out of your mouth.
That's crazy.
Truly don't think I have.
But no, like I can't get that. Like it would be like like, if Breonna Stewart won Defensive Player of the Year this year and someone gave Sabrina a vote, I would have the same monologue. Because, like, yeah, she got better. No, she wasn't the best defender in her backcourt, much less the best defender in the league. Like, I don't get how you get there. Like, if Asia won it this year and the vote went to one of the Aces guards, I was like, no, that's not how that... It's like a fundamental misunderstanding of what makes that defense good. To go that route.
Is it a misunderstanding or a differing belief?
Yes. Absolutely. Could not agree more. I'm trying to go down the line. Like, again, it's not like specific to her. Like if Alyssa Thomas won it this year and Ty Harris got a defensive player of the year vote, I would be like, what are we doing here? Or if Marina got a defensive player of the year vote, like, what are we doing here?
Well, 2017, Elena Beard won Defensive Player of the Year for the Sparks. Candace Parker received two votes. Take it up with the GOAT, bud. Take it up with the GOAT, bud, huh?
Hey, Elena Beard was a monster, you know? But, like, she got after it. But it's like, no, man. No, that's not how that's supposed to... That's not how that's supposed to vote. Like, if Ezzie Mabigore won Defensive Player of the Year and the DPOY vote went to, like, Jewel, and we talked about it on the pod, I thought Jewel had a good defensive season. But, like, no. No. That, no.
What do you mean? guards play defense, bigs play defense.
They
defense.
Sure do. Everyone has to do their part. And I don't think Minnesota finishes second in defensive rating if Courtney Williams is, like, awful defensively. She was not. But no. Again, I say all of this with the obvious caveat. I don't have an official awards ballot. So, like, my word literally means nothing in this context.
I tell, like, you what, whoever voted for Courtney Williams is going to work to make sure you still don't.
Boy, I tell you what. Man. If that's where the flag gets planted and that's how I lose out, then it was a valiant cause, I suppose. Either way, while we're talking defense, actually circling back, because, like, not on that portion. I'm done with that rant. My thoughts are well publicized at this point. Nafisa Collier, I think, was one of five players to average at least one steal and one block per game this year. Second in steals, sixth in blocks, fourth in defensive rebounds. Going to, like, some of the second spectrum stuff, she was third in pick and roll defense among 33 players to defend at least 300. Alana Smith and Alicia Clark were the only two players ahead of her, and, like, they were, like, tenths ahead of her in that regard. And, like, in the case of Alicia Clark, like, it was, like, a little over 300 reps. So she just met the minimum requirement for that I was filtering for. And so if you're talking about, like, legitimate high volume stuff, like, it was really just Alana and Fee. But then a graphic that came up on the ESPN broadcast yesterday with Nafisa Collier as the closest defender, minimum of 100 shots defended. First in field goal percentage allowed. Also first in effective field goal percentage allowed. And mentioned a little bit earlier, a 93.8 defensive rating with Fee on the court. And compare that to the other players that received defensive player of the year votes. A 100 even for Asia Wilson, a 97.2 with Ezzy on the floor in Seattle. A 96.4 with Dejounte on the court. And again, Courtney Williams, a 92.5 with her on the floor. A lot of those minutes naturally being shared with Nafisa Collier, who won the award. But Fee had a case. Like, I don't think you have to, like, make up stuff to get to Fee Defensive Player of the Year. She was really good and she was very important. Like, I don't think as aggressively as Minnesota helps and as aggressively as they rotate and stuff, like, that doesn't work without Fee communicating and rotating and getting deflections and blowing up catches and using her length to contest shots. And so even if she isn't getting the block, she's altering shots at the rim. Like, she just does a whole lot of stuff. The late switches that they sprinkle in, if Fee couldn't hold up against guards, they wouldn't be able to do that with the volume that they do it at. And certainly wouldn't be able to do it with the efficiency that they do it at. Like, she is just a really good defender. And, like, it's not even like she came out of nowhere. She literally made an all-defense team last year. So, I don't know. Those are my defensive player of the year thoughts. To the all-defense teams, your first team was Nafisa Collier, Asia Wilson, Breanna Stewart, Dejounte Carrington, and Izzy Madbigore. Your second team was Alyssa Thomas, Alana Smith, Neko Gumake, Jonquil Jones, and Natasha Cloud. Steve, do you have any thoughts on the all-defensive teams?
10 spots, 8 bigs, 2 guards. I had most of these names. Dejounte first team, salute. I appreciate the respect on guard defense, but no real surprises here for me. You?
No surprises. Like, these were literally the 10 names that I had. I just had a couple of names swap. Like, I think I had Alyssa and Alana on the first team and Dejounte and Ezzy on the second team. But beyond that, like, these are quite literally the 10 names that I had. So I don't have any real complaints there. Last award thing before we get into these game ones, Shel Reeve named both coach of the year and executive of the year. The first person since Kurt Miller to win both in the same season, but 62 of the 67 coach of the year votes, Sandy Rondello getting 4 and Christy Sides getting 1 of the New York Liberty and Indiana Fever respectively. And she was on 10 of the 12 ballots for executive of the year. Like, that award voted on by, like, top executive of each team. You can't vote for yourself. And so it was Shel Reeve first, Talisa Ray of Seattle. She was on 8 ballots, Darius Taylor on 7 ballots. So, the Minnesota Lynx, 30-10 in the regular season, 4th in offense, 2nd in defense, 3rd in net rating. Massive improvements from last season where they were 19-21. They were 8th in offense, 10th in defense, 10th in net rating. And an offseason in which you add Alana Smith and Courtney Williams, who were very good for your basketball teams, certainly helps you get in the hunt for executive of the year. You get to teach a Heideman in there as well. Cecilia Zandalasini adding that kind of bench depth. Quality offseason for Minnesota. Again, one of the best teams in the league. Well-deserved from my point of view. Did you have any thoughts on Coach of the Year or Executive of the Year?
Listen to the Dunker Spot Award episode.
There you go. Cyclone back. We got timestamps for you. We good. Okay. Trade stuff is done. Award stuff is done. We have two very interesting game ones to talk through. The first game on the slate was the New York Liberty getting an 87-77 victory over the Las Vegas Aces. Breanna Stewart setting the tone, 20 points in the first half, 34 points overall to lead all scorers, 21 points for Sabrina Ionescu, 13-12 for Jonquel Jones. So the double-double equals win streak continues for Jonquel in a New York Liberty uniform. 4 points, 4 boards, 3 assists, 2 steals, and a block for Benai Jelani. But those last two numbers, the 2 steals and a block, is what stands out to me. And even beyond like the actual box score stuff, her defense was insane for most of that basketball game. But beyond the box score stuff, I think if you're the New York Liberty, this is what you want a win to look like, just broadly speaking. Like this kind of establishing, we are bigger than you. We are longer than you. We can restrict space. We can force you late into the clock. We're going to make you think. We're going to make you, you have to move the ball. You have to move your bodies. However, depending on what lineups you have out there, we just have consistent help points and we can kind of dictate where you're going. And so the defense was absolutely the story for me, just seeing what some of the cross matches was going to look like. We once again, you know, on the Aces side, we saw Kia Stokes and Breanna Stewart. We also saw Stewie just kind of roaming off of Kia Stokes, Jonquel on Asia. The way that they not only flooded the paint, but consistently tried to meet Asia on the catch or on drives, she was not able to establish any kind of consistent rhythm. Wasn't a bad game for Asia. Actually led the team in assists because she was able to pass out of some of those doubles. But ultimately, they didn't allow her to establish herself as, I'm scoring 14 in the first quarter or something like that. She didn't get the extended stretches of dominance offensively. She wasn't able to get to the rim a ton in this basketball game. And so just watching that defensive foundation from New York, like it's something that I've been impressed with all season long, and it was loud in that game one. And on the other end, Breanna Stewart just deciding, hey, none of you can guard me. It's like a lot of fun for me as a basketball fan because this is the type of talent that Stewie is and something that I wrote about over the weekend when previewing the series, making some bold predictions, et cetera. One thing I noted and looked up was like, you know, watching the games, it hasn't felt like Stewie's had a lot of fun against the Aces. And so actually getting the numbers on that front, it's like, oh, no, she really hasn't been efficient or to her usual standard against the Aces. And so for her to come out immediately, I'm getting to the rim. I'm getting to my midi. I'm pulling up for three early. I'm going to score on all three levels. Depending on who your defender is, I'm going to bully them and shoot over the top of them. We're going to tap right back into the guard screening for Stewie bag, both off the ball and on the ball. Going to move you around. And it just doesn't matter. And if that's going to be the bit for the Liberty, like this becomes a substantially more difficult series for the Aces to deal with. Because the Liberty's talent level already just poses such a problem for you. But the Aces have been able to bring it closer. And again, going back to the finals, ultimately win it because Stewie hasn't been herself. When Asia's gotten a matchup, she's held her own. When Alicia Clark has gotten a matchup specifically, she's really held her own. And it just didn't feel like the Aces had a real handle on Stewie. And when you zoom out from there and Jonquel, again, it's just a walking mismatch when she's on the floor. Sabrina Ionescu, mixing in drives and mixing in deep shots from three on top of that, like watching the screen depth on pick and rolls just kind of shift around throughout the game. Let's do this from the wing. Let's set this one from 40 feet. Let's see what you do with it. Let's go double drag from 35 feet out. Let's see what y'all do with it. And watching the poise from Sabrina and how she was navigating that was very impressive to me. When their big three performs like that, on top of their defense being set like that, it's not impossible for the Aces, but it is really freaking difficult. So I know we'll get into more particulars, but those are just some of my broader stroke observations from that game one.
I think the Liberty had the mindset they needed to in game one. I think to start off with the Breanna Stewart point was huge. I think for me, it was not just the bucket getting was fantastic. The aggression was great. It was being able to, for lack of a better term, cycle through matchups for what felt like the first time against the Aces. typically there's been one where it started to take something away. We're taking the drives away. We're making it tough for you to post. We're going to take something away from you. Really decisive early. Really quick decisions. Wanted to get to her spots. Turn the corner, drive. Liberty, of course, running sets to clear the right side for her to get her drive. But also, okay, Alicia Carr's guarding me. Let me get down to the post. Quick turn, no doubles. Chelsea Gray's guarding me. Let me wait. Let me seal. Quick turn. Now we go. Having a transition. No one really's picked me up. I'm going to go to my pull-up. Just kind of have that laser focus offensively, and that becomes important because now if Stewie's playing at that high of a level, the Liberty offense just flows a lot better because you now have something you can get to pretty consistently. Now, you saw in that second half, Gresham was still there. Foul trouble hit. The point of the game where Liberty had the toughest time offensively was when, okay, does Stewie have it? Does Sabrina have it? Are we moving the ball? Are we moving our bodies? But you saw just how much this game meant to Breanna Stewart by how she came out and sent the message time and time again. I think that one of the biggest things for me was the Liberty defense and their activity and how hard they worked to cut off the paint and what that looks like going forward in the series. I mean, they were active early, aggressive help from the nail and the wings. They established that. They want to take away driving lanes early. I think you go back and watch that first quarter. There's a body, a Liberty body, as soon as an ace thought about. Well, don't even think about it. There's someone on the left and the right. You swing it, that's cool. There's someone on the left and the right. Transition, showing bodies. We're showing help. Now, what was interesting over the course of the game, I'm sure we'll touch on it, the aces continuing to drive, and now the Liberty rotations still being there, but were these rotations that they wanted to make or these rotations that they had to make because they were beat? The aces being able to mix in cutting throughout the course of the game is pretty good. And so is that something they can now try and lean on? I thought the aces generated a lot of quality looks off penetration. They didn't knock many of them down. Does that change the game? But when you look at what Bonai Jelani Hamilton did to set the tone early for the Liberty defensively, active denials in the right spot, help, I thought that was fantastic. And I think that New York Liberty lineup just has a little bit of versatility to poke at the aces. You know, if you want to use Kia Stokes as a screener in that lineup, Stewie's in there, so we can make that a switch. Jonquel's back there somewhere. We take the roller, we can figure it out. Okay, now you want to use Asia Wilson as a screener. Well, Stewie's on the ball, so guess what? It's a switch. And now, you know, there's only so much the aces can manipulate, but the Liberty can kind of just try and poke at things that way. I thought the work the Liberty did defensively against Asia, they tried to keep her out of rhythm, which sounds like an insane thing to say considering how well she's played all year. But I think the things for me were probably how and when they showed help on her drives and the random doubles once the moves had been initiated, where Stewie just said, oh, you are going into this. I'm here. Like, I'm just going to come and just be tall around you. Now, you saw in the second half, had time to make quick decisions, had time to get downhill. I would expect Asia to be very aggressive in the next game. So it'll be interesting. But I think for me, I salute the Liberty's defense because they set the tone early and gave them a shot to extend the lead and hold on to it.
The Asia portion is going to be interesting because as we've talked about throughout the year, like the Aces have really done a good job of moving her around and making it difficult to send that kind of help. And so for the Liberty to be able to still nail that for most of the game, I think is a testament to their attention to detail and, again, just the overall defensive talent that they add. And so I am curious to see what scheme tweaks are made in terms of how Asia's getting the ball and where she's getting it, or if it's just going to be a matter of, hey, let's just do this better, or if it's just Asia saying, okay, I just got to go quicker. We're not changing, like, the volume of face-ups or the volume of off-ball screens that I'm receiving or, you know, the amount of Chelsea, Asia pick and roll, anything like that. When I catch the ball, I just got to go because I know they're going to try to go. Let me find my window immediately to see what it does. So curious about that part. The bounce off of what you said about the Aces drives. From Second Spectrum, it was 48 drives for the Aces in game one, 0.8 points per possession on those trips. And to your point, it was a tale of two halves. In that first half, 23 drives for the Aces, 0.58 points per possession on any trip featuring an Aces drive. In that second half, you get the other 25 drives, 1 point per possession. And so If you're the Aces, did you find something? Is what you were able to get in terms of New York rotating, to your point, is that replicable in game two? And if it is, can we capitalize? Because it wasn't a great three-point shooting game overall. Like, outside of, like, Kelsey Plum had it going. But didn't feel like anyone else had it going with, like, real volume in that game one. So, like, can you capitalize on those looks if the Liberty are going to help as aggressively as you saw on some of those drives in the second half, some of those collapses? You know, that was a possession in, I want to say, the third quarter, where Aces missed to get an offensive rebound. You get it back to Asia, looks like four Liberty players collapse in the paint, and it's just Kelsey Plum at the top of the key wide open for three. Are you able to clean up some of those instances if you're the Liberty and kind of tighten that up? Or if you're the Aces, if you get that look again, can you capitalize? Does that change how New York wants to help now? And can you now find an avenue for more consistent offense if you're the Aces? So that's going to be an interesting thing to track heading into the game too. Beyond Asia, and again, Kelsey Plum, it felt like a really good game for her. I think her drives were very important. She led the game in drives on the individual level. But the timing of some of her drives, I think, were very important for the Aces. And just the general timing of, I'm catching, I know they want to load up, let me attack this gap and let me get downhill. Or let me reject and try to get downhill. You could tell the Liberty were working hard to try to take away some of those gaps, but she was just able to find them anyway. Like, the Aces are just going to have to get more of that in game two and moving forward. Because any slippage there, like, I do kind of worry about where the rim protection, where the rim pressure comes from, if KSC is able to be corralled in a real way. Because, and we'll talk about it, but, you know, Chelsea wasn't able to get downhill consistently in this game. Jackie had pockets, but she wasn't able to threaten the rim like we saw in the most recent regular season matchup, to where the Aces just start the game saying, we're getting Jackie downhill, we're getting her against Sabrina, let's attack this matchup. It wasn't the same success. It wasn't the same volume for Jackie Young in that regard. The Liberty surely weren't letting Tiffany Hayes have much fun in that game one. And so naturally you want to see the Aces find ways to open those players up in game two. But it does also highlight just how important the drives were from Kelsey Plum and how important the shot making was in light of the shooting woes elsewhere. Actually, I'll stop there. Like, how did you feel about the Aces others in this one?
I felt fine. I thought everyone did their job. I think it's going to be interesting to see if the Aces can hit the right combinations and what they feel those combinations are and how deep do you want to go. Well, you know, Alicia Clark had some really good cuts. Mm-hmm. She knocks down another three. It looks different. I imagine Tiff Hayes will be a little bit more aggressive, and if she's able to get in the paint and cause a little havoc, looks a little different for the Aces. So I think that's the tricky part about this series and this game. These two teams are not going to surprise each other. Mm. You know, where the kids, it's cinema. Like, these two teams are going to go at it back and forth. You have to keep whatever you are finding success with, you have to keep doing it because the other team is not going away. I think for me, the larger point outside of finding the right combinations, I think for the Aces, just keep your tempo up, move the basketball, get your player moving up, get your ball moving up. You generated good shots. It's not necessarily always going to be the matchups. No, the Liberty are going to switch. You're going to get some good looks against Sabrina on some drives. It's about the consistency. Can you now mix in the individual plays with, we're now moving at a pace where you're having to rotate and we're getting another drive on top of that. And now we can continue to generate the type of shots that we want to generate. Mm-hmm. If we can get Asian space, if we can keep you rotating, if we can generate quality looks, I think the Aces feel good about what they could do against the Liberty. I think for the Liberty, you have to try and keep the Aces bogged down to a degree. Try and continue to dictate and show help. Try and make them make mistakes. And that's the battle. That's always been the battle to some degree. The Liberty are a little bit better built to not have to show as much help as they did in the past, where it was literally, hey, we all have to be in here and they can drive and kick and shoot threes. And now we're trying to close out. But that battle's still there.
Another broader note I would just say, in favor of the Liberty in this case, is because of what they were able to do defensively and because of what they were able to find on the other end. Like, it didn't feel like the Aces had a lineup that they were super comfortable with. Like, they felt like there was always something that could be poked at.
That's the Stewie factor.
It is.
In that case, and it's also the Aces weren't clean defensively for chunks of the game factor. Mm-hmm. Which doesn't help that.
It does not. And like, I asked Becky about like some of the botches with switching in particular in the game one. And she was like, she didn't feel like it was like the biggest reason that they lost, or because, you know, the frame for me was like, did you feel like that was attention to detail lapses for you? Or did you feel like New York was doing anything in particular to kind of put you in some bad spots? And she's like, not really, was where she started with. And she went into just the general tempo and the speed in which New York was running some of the stuff that they were running. And just, you know, to bounce off of your point, it didn't feel like the tempo was consistent for the Aces in the half court. Like, there was a general layer of, we have to work really hard because New York is just good defensively. They're physical off ball. They're denying. We're getting later in the clock because of some of the things that New York is doing. But there was a little bit of, and Becky alluded to this as well, like, there was an element of catch and hold that I don't think they can afford in this series. And so I do think there is room for the Aces. There's just some room for self-improvement there. Like, let's jog this up. Like, it's not going to be super easy to deal with Banaja Laney full court pressure. We saw that very early in the game. But, like, do we see a second player in the backcourt? All right, let's toss it here. Let's just get it past half court at 19 or 20. Does that give us a little bit more room to kind of poke at what the Liberty want to do help-wise and things like that? There are also, again, some margin things, like something that we talked about during the game or something that I brought up during the game. Like, we know that the Liberty are going to help off of Kia Stokes. And so natural counters for Kia is going to be, you know, when she receives the ball, let's flow into an immediate handoff. Let's see if we can get a guard a shot. Or if she's kind of on the weak side, all right, let me set this pin in, or let me set this flare, or whatever. Like, I didn't feel like it was a great screening game for Kia in a game one. And so if you're in a position where New York is helping off, you're not generating extra looks for your teammates with your screening. And then on the other end, you have the Stewie assignment, and New York immediately is like, hey, let's make you navigate. Here's a pin down. Actually, Stewie's going back door. You can't catch up. Here's a shot at the rim. Like, I don't think Kia can afford those. And then as you downsize, as you mentioned, Alicia Clark hit some big shots, but she wasn't able to hold Stewie to the same degree. And when Stewie got the Alicia Clark matchup, she was almost treating Alicia like Kia in a similar way to where, oh, you're spaced. I will be around the free throw line anyway. And I trust that I can recover out and contest the shot. And so I do wonder, you know, similar question, how much of that is the do better button for the Aces? Versus what kind of tweaks do we see? It's like, we didn't see Megan Gustafson in game one at all. Does she get a shot in game two? I think you are taking a natural hit defensively if you do, but is she able to overcome that with, you know, better screening, better handoffs? Also, I will just get some volume up from three. And does that make that more tenable for the Aces? So, like, I am curious about that aspect as well. And I guess while I'm here just on the Aces portion of the program, like, it was a quiet game for Chelsea Gray offensively. Like, very early on, a couple of pick and rolls with Asia where she has Jonquel in a drop. She's able to kind of get to the mid-range jumper. And after that, like, it was just quiet for her. And, like, one of the questions that I've had for you when talking about this matchup, especially since she came back, was like, okay, what quality of looks is she generating? Because she only needs so much space. Again, we're not that far removed from one of the greatest shot-making playoff runs we have ever seen. So she only needs a sliver of space. But she's had to work so hard to generate stuff, just in general, against the Liberty this year. And they need her to be able to hit that button. Like, that's what's going to help take the Aces to another level. Like, there are things to correct for themselves. They need to move the ball better. As you mentioned, the second half, they got some more of the cutting and moving New York. But that has to be more consistent. But you want that baseline. And you also want the, we can't do anything with that possessions. The Asia contested stuff that she's the unanimous MVP for a reason. You need some of those. Chelsea Gray is an insane shot maker. You're going to need some of those. Kelsey, the mix of drives and pull-ups. Like, you're going to need those. Drives and pull-ups for Jackie, you're going to need those. If Jackie and Chelsea are going to combine for 21 on 23 shots, and 17 of those are from Jackie, like, that's not going to be enough against this team. Like, it just gets, again, not impossible, but it gets difficult. Well, more difficult, rather.
You'll have to talk to me at the end of the series and open up the box score and show me exactly how the shots didn't go down. You can't just bake in Chelsea Gray and Jackie Young. Don't shoot the ball well. Sorry.
No, you can't. Yeah, that's a very dull, like, hey, you need production from your best players, but you do. And I think, again, just to the Chelsea portion, like, there's just a level of length that New York can throw that it's just generally been difficult for her to get to these same spots. And so the one thing that she was able to get to early was that pick and roll with Asia, getting Banaja behind her, kind of snaking pick and rolls and get to those spots there. Like, is it just going to be pressing that button more? And of course, that I tossed to you during the game was, hey, at what point does New York, like, what's the threshold on that in particular? And when does New York start turning that into a switch? And you naturally countered with, hey, I don't know if they want to switch Banaja onto Asia, which makes sense. But I don't know. Those are just some of the thoughts that I've had with that one. Overall, yeah, I just land more on New York did a tremendous job of bothering the aces and poking at things. Like, I think the size really stood out. And you really saw that with the roaming defensively. Like, we can just naturally shrink the floor. And also, if you have someone out there that we aren't super worried about, we can make this even more difficult. So I just got to land on a very quality game for the New York Liberty in this one.
Let's see. My final thoughts. Sabrina, timely, quick decisions, played her game. The threes were timely. She made some really big ones when they needed them, but didn't overuse them. I thought the screen navigation would be very interesting from the aces in game two. Can they clean the coverages up? Because they had cross matches, and it was like, okay, are we switching this one? Are we not switching that one? I think that will help their overall defense and try and get the Liberty deeper in the clock. The margin for error, slim for the Liberty. They can't have a foul trouble game.
Yeah. And to your earlier point, was it four fouls in the third quarter for Stewie? Like, that has to be a first for her to get four and a quarter. And some of those calls were incredibly funny, but this is going back through the box score very quickly. Mentioned Stewie's with game high 34, Sabrina with 21 and 5 assists. Also had 2 steals and a block in this one. 13 and 12 for Jonquil Jones, a steal and a block. Banaja, quiet box score in terms of the offense, 4 points, 4 boards, 3 assists. But 2 steals and a block and her full court pressure was very impactful against the Las Vegas Aces. Courtney Vanderstoot with 3 points, 4 assists, and 2 steals off the bench. 40 Aces, 21 points, 6 boards, 5 assists, and 2 blocks for Asia Wilson. 24 points and 4 assists for Kelsey Plum. 12 of those points coming in the third. 17 points for Jackie Young, 2 steals as well. And just quickly bounced off the screen navigation thing. She really worked her tail off against Sabrina Ionescu, particularly in that second half. But again, that's just what makes this difficult. You have to put in that kind of work. And there's also just a level of rim pressure that the Aces need from Jackie and shot making. It's not an easy job. So I don't want to undersell that portion of the program. But 9 points, 5 boards and a block for Alicia Clark. 4 points, 3 rebounds, an assist and a block in 26 minutes for Chelsea Gray in the game one. Game two on Tuesday. So by the time you listen to this, might be getting started. Or that game may be coming up soon. So we'll see what that game two is going to look like. To the second game of the night on Sunday, the Connecticut Sun taking home court. Keith 73-70 road win over the Minnesota Lynx. A near triple double for Alyssa Thomas in this one. Big shots made for Marina Mabry. Some deep shots made for Marina Mabry in this one. En route to a game high 20 points. 19-9 for Nafisa Collier. 17 points for Bridget Carlton. On a very basic note, this game was a lot of fun for me. And just watching these teams try to poke at what the other is doing. The Lynx trying to establish their help, the Sun trying to establish their physicality, the switching from both ends. It felt like both teams had their pockets, particularly in that first half, of just being deep in the clock and just finding a way to get buckets late in this one. And so I really just enjoyed the cat and mouse. Like, it felt like, again, just on a very general note before digging in, like, this is kind of what I was expecting from both of these teams. Like, this was the kind of series that I was anticipating. Low scoring. We got to find our pockets. We got to work really hard here. If we mess up, they're going to bring us even deeper in the mud. And we're going to have to work this out. So let the transition baskets, really going to have to work. And so I just loved watching this game. As far as other takeaways from this one, though, I thought Alyssa Thomas was incredible in this game. There were some, I want to say it was the second quarter, that I was kind of joking with you, like, hey, these are some possessions that I'm not used to seeing from Alyssa Thomas in terms of the help and where she was on some of these. But overall, like, she was trusted to defend Nafisa Collier on an island. You also saw a lot of DeWanna Bonner on Nafisa Collier after they were switching. She was trusted to do so on an island. But Alyssa Thomas held her own when she got the feed matchup. The selective traps and kind of blowing things up in pick and roll were very fun for me. She was pretty aggressive in this basketball game. Again, a 17-point effort in this one that could have been higher. But like watching her kind of cycle side to side with her handoffs, the screen to open up the guards, and then just kind of finding the pockets to get all the way downhill against Nafisa Collier, or getting into the push shot, getting some time, making some timely buckets there. Like, it just felt like a tone setting game for Alyssa Thomas, particularly with her aggression in the first half. The defense was really sound in this one. The playmaking was important. And I think the Sun overall, don't want to sound cliche and say they found the offense when they needed it, but it did feel like they had more of a plan offensively than I anticipated late in this game. Because like one of the questions that I've had about Connecticut throughout the season, and really just throughout this run, if you want to zoom out to the last couple of years, is what does the late game offense look like when they have these kind of help points? Like, can they generate good stuff? And I felt like they were able to find some answers in this one. It was also interesting to see them close with Veronica Burton over Bree Jones in this game. I'm sure we'll get more into the lineup bag on that front. But Dawana Bonner, timely shot making. Marina Mabry, timely shot making. Again, Alyssa Thomas was just tremendous on both ends of the floor in this one. Timely drives from Dejanay Carrington as well. Like, it was just a total team effort and an impressive win on the road.
Now, when you say they only made four field goals in the last 5 minutes, so, I mean, it certainly got
ugly in terms of the result. But no, just in terms of, okay, well, I know what we are trying to establish. Like, sometimes shots fall and they don't. It was more process brain for me.
What was the process for you that you liked in the fourth from the Sun?
I don't know. Like, I think just in general, like, the hub work and then also trying to work and get Marina off ball.
You mean Marina shooting the ball?
No, she was very aggressive in it.
I mean, this is the way. I mean, I think Marina, Dawana woke up in the fourth. Marina had that big three in the fourth. It was a back and forth fest. I mean, this is what you thought the Sun-Link series would be. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like it. Game of runs was a definition of this game.
Yeah.
Sun going a 9-2 run in the first quarter. Lynx going that 13-0 run for like forever in the second quarter. Sun going a long 7-2 run. Then the Lynx answer back. Just back and forth. I think for me, the key is it's hard to put Connecticut away. They know who they are. They know what they want to get to. And I think this is why, you go get Marina Mabry. It's not just that she made the threes. Obviously, you want her to make six threes. It's big. She's going to take them. There's no question. There's no searching. To kind of add to your point, we have an outcome. Even if it takes us 17 dribble handoffs and we're 30 feet away from the basket and we're hoping Dawana and or Marina does something, hey, at least we moved the ball to get there. I thought both teams worked to try and find their efforts. I thought Minnesota showcased that they can still get good looks. They can keep moving the ball. Connecticut is a defense that's going to make it tough on you as a movement team. And so kind of reminds me of the Sun Liberty series from last year to a degree, where it's like, yes, this is good, but now you have to find it in a different way. The pressure is heightened up. How are you going to execute down the stretch? Are you going to be able to find those same pockets? Especially as I thought when Connecticut decided, you know what, let's just go small. Let's try and find a level of versatility on D that's important. We saw that in the Fever series when they were able to have multiple schemes and feel comfortable doing different things, the impact it had for them. For Connecticut, being able to switch at times, show help, get more comfort with who they're helping off of, the timing of their help. I thought they had really good activity. And so it's not something that Minnesota hadn't seen. I mean, Phoenix was literally trying to do that the entire series. I think the difference is Connecticut's got a little bit different physicality. And it's not the only thing they're doing. So you have just enough of quote-unquote normal coverages to feel comfortable and not necessarily lock in on the switches. There are times where I thought if he's Collier had a mismatch, ball didn't go to her. And so that will be something that I'm interested to see how Minnesota adjusts. And if they can poke at Connecticut's small lineup or Connecticut switching in a way that now makes Connecticut have to blink, which is very hard. These are two teams that don't blink. Connecticut does what they do on both ends of the floor. Minnesota does what they do on both ends of the floor. May the best team win. And so I think for Minnesota, you got to find that blend. I thought some of their best success was when they had the drives going and they were able to get rejects and get in the paint and open things up. But I think one of the key things for me was Minnesota, 27 made field goals, 16 assists.
Not their
fault. You tell me the last time the Lynx had sub 20 assists.
Can pull that box score very quickly. But yeah, to your point, like, Minnesota quite literally set the assist rate record this year. And I think that's...
Hey, you know who set the assist rate record last year?
The New York Liberty.
Hey, you know who had a tough time with the...
I think I'm picking up what you're putting down. But yeah, like, I think that's the other thing that kind of popped for me as I try to pull this up very quickly to get the 20 assist stat for you. It did feel like a lot of one-on-one from Minnesota. And like Connecticut kind of trusting, like, no, we can just kind of hold our own. Because like one thing that popped for me, like, I just looked at the box score during the game. And I think one of our chat members brought it up initially. I was like, hey, it doesn't feel like Minnesota's taking a lot of threes in this game either. And like, that's normally like a baked in math battle that they would have in this matchup. Because Connecticut, obviously, they take more with Marina, but like, they still aren't a high volume 3-point shooting team. The fact that Connecticut felt comfortable mixing in the amount of switches that they did, and they were really selective about when they were sending help and who they were sending it to, they were able to kind of neutralize some of that math advantage for Minnesota. And I do wonder if, you know, related to Minnesota poking at different things in game two, like if that's an avenue for them to kind of open that back up and be able to generate more of those kind of looks.
Well, I think it comes down to the type of shots they're able to generate. I think that's where, again, you need to move. You need to scramble Connecticut's defense. You need to see if you can find the right openings. I mean, they shot 5 of 20 from 3. Bridget Carlton shot 3 of 6. I'm no math major, but that's 2 of 14 for everyone else. Mm-hmm. It's probably not the mix you want.
There you go. Also, to answer your question, the last time the Minnesota Lynx did not have at least 20 assists was the last day of the regular season where they sat the Feast of Collier. I think they also sat Caleb McBride, but they had
that doesn't count.
Okay, well, outside of the resting game, September 8th against the Washington Mystics, they had 19 and a 78-71 victory.
That's very on brand.
And then before that, it was 16 on August 15th, first game after the Olympic break against, you guessed it, the Washington Mystics. And then before that, it was 14 on July 12th against the Seattle Storm. Notably, a good defense.
So, yeah. Do you have any concerns with Minnesota's ability to generate quality looks in this series?
Not yet, I guess is where I would start. Because I think something that you mentioned was going to be something that I brought up like a little bit later. Fee getting some of these mismatches and Minnesota having to work as hard as they can to get her the ball and or the ball just does not find her. Like, I don't know if they can afford to have as many of those pockets as they did in game one. Like, it feels like easily replicable stuff or easy to fix stuff for Minnesota, rather. I can get my words together. Going to passages that we talked about was Fee getting a smaller player switched onto her. Didn't have the angle at the top of the key to swing to the wing to eventually get it to her. They were able to play out of that. They just have to be more intentional. They have to be a little bit quicker about taking advantage of those mismatches. Because I do think in general, they have to get to a point to where even if they don't take the switching from Connecticut all the way off the table, they at least need to make them think about, okay, are we comfortable switching this? Or if we do switch this, do we need to immediately send help on some of these? And can that open up some of the swing sequences that we've seen from Minnesota this year? So I'm not like pressing the big red button on them yet, but I do think they left some food on the table in game one for sure.
I think it's going to be interesting to see the minute distribution and can the Lynx poke at Bree Jones in the same way they did? Mm-hmm. To where are you going to be comfortable? Are you going to be at the level? They tried trapping, tried showing hard, they tried dropping back. Minnesota was able to kind of poke at that a little bit. I think Connecticut needs both lineups to function well. Mm-hmm. If you're only going to give them a small lineup, the Lynx just played that. So while your defense is a little bit stronger, I don't know if you want to buckle into that.
This is true. And this, again, just bouncing off of that, like it's like three games is such a small sample, but it is three playoff games. Like it just hasn't been the same Bree Jones. And it's starting to get pretty concerning for me on that front, especially in light of how strongly she closed the regular season. But it's 4 points, 5 boards against the Fever in game one, 8 points and 1 board against the Fever in game two, 6 points and 2 boards in game three. And she only played the opening minute and 30 of the fourth quarter. And it was essentially Veronica Burton time from there. So again, like it's props to Stephanie White for recognizing, okay, this lineup is probably going to give us more success. We need to close this out. And they end up getting the win. But you need your all-star. As cliche and as simple-minded as that sounds, like you kind of need your all-star. Like that's going to help. I think that helps you turn the tide. And to your point, if Minnesota feels like the small ball unit is really where Kinetics is going to go. And if we can start to ding that with some off ball stuff, with some pick and rolls, we can now get the ball to feet quicker. And now she's just cycling through matchups and things like that. It gets tougher. And like, these are really good defenses, but it gets tougher in that regard. Cause I think with Bree in general, even when she's playing well, like you're like it's a mix of dropping at the level. So you feel like there may be pull-up pockets there, especially with how often Minnesota goes with empty side actions. Maybe able to get to some pull-ups. If they're having it at the level, that's two on the ball, and we move and we cut well generally. And so she has to kind of counteract that with some of the post-ups, the foul drawing, the random sprinkled in mid-range jumpers. Like, they just need that portion, to your point, to make both of those lineups hit. Like, in theory, you want to be able to mash the paint, draw some fouls, win the offensive glass. Now you can cycle into Olivia Nelson Adoh to come in. You can get more scheme versatile. You can switch more. You can trap more if you want to. And it just feels like a wave. But without that, it just gets tougher. So I would like to see a more active and engaged and more efficient Bree Jones in game two.
Well, the highest compliment you can get is the way that teams have defended her in the playoffs, which is no, absolutely not.
That's
true. We're not letting you do what you do in the regular season and just seal everyone deep below. No. And we're also going to make it hard on the other end so you don't play as many minutes. Like, that's their job.
Yeah.
So Bree Jones got to respond. But yeah, my job is to try and play you off the court.
You're right. But again, to your point, like, she's going to have to respond. And so I am excited to see if that response comes in game two, because that could just make life a little easier for Connecticut if she does.
I think one thing I'm watching for a minute from Minnesota, it's not necessarily that Connecticut switching bogged them down to a degree. I think they still made quick decisions. The problem is it was just very east-west adjacent. And the only thing that was getting in the paint as the game wore on was post-ups. And so can they get the driving kick and get Connecticut to rotate in a different way? I think that's the key to try and counteract. I think they've got the tempo. I think they got the mindset. They got the style of play. They're going to make Connecticut keep doing it. But if this is a series that's going to be tight, which I think we anticipate it will be, can you navigate and find the right ways to know when we need to throw it in the post, when we have a drive, when we're forcing a drive, where the kicks are, and keep the confidence up that way? Because Connecticut is... You know, a lot of people want to point to what they do offensively and the grind they play. They are comfortable playing deep in the clock. Very comfortable playing deep in the clock. Very comfortable playing in the mud. Dawana Bonner didn't look like she was going to be able to make another shot. Guess what happened in the fourth corner? Dawana Bonner showed up. You know, Alyssa Thomas hits the biggest shot of the game. How many of those shots did she take in that game?
Like four or five.
So, you know, that this is where the Sun are a team that you have to go beat, and game two is going to be very interesting. How does Minnesota respond on both ends of the floor?
One thing I would mention on the Minnesota front, and more so related to Connecticut's defense than anything, just once again, keeping an eye on Alanna Smith and some of the help that Connecticut was showing in that game.
What do you mean by that, bud? What do you mean, pal?
One
more friend.
nothing new. Just a general spacing point. She's being giving some of these shots from above the break in particular. And she's going to have to knock those down, because you don't want that to be as consistent as a help point as it was in that game one for Connecticut. I think you can help solve some of the, maybe solve isn't the right word, but I think you have more answers offensively if those shots are going down, or if maybe if the process is tilted a little bit to, okay, I'm catching out here, I'm immediately flowing into something with one of these guards stationed right beside me. Is that another way for them to add to, again, the three-point volume that wasn't there to their usual level in game one? But I am just in general keeping an eye on the Atlanta spot offensively.
Hey, which one of these teams plays the eighth player off the bench first?
You know... Would it be Minnie by default?
Maybe I asked you though.
No, because like we just didn't see because Sam Lucini was just out, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, each team played seven. Yeah.
So I think if she is available, I think that becomes eight just to get the extra juice and shot creation. With Connecticut, I guess my question would be like, where would you go? It's like, again, Tiffany Mitchell, get well soon. Like, Tiffany Mitchell is just out right now. I guess Ty Harris was listed as question. She was listed as questionable, I believe, right? And just didn't play. So if Ty's back for game two, I think there's your natural answer.
I got you.
Yeah, I think that'd be my answer to that one. Any concern about the Kayla McBride usage in game one? Or was that just more of an element of Connecticut defending her well? Or just taking away some of the off-ball stuff? It did feel quiet outside of like that surge, I want to say, in the second quarter.
I mean, I guess for me, it would be, I don't know if she got the same blend of drives and shots that she wanted, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was a bad game. But I think there's probably, if she were to watch the film, there's some gaps where probably could have tapped there. Probably forced the issue on that drive. Just got to play within her game and not speed it up. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's kind of part of the pressure of what McBride and Williams have to do for this team, to where you're playing with so many tempo, you get so many handoffs. Well, is my shot here this time? Is my drive here this time? Mm-hmm. I think they'll bounce back.
Okay. Which, again, you naturally give a little bit of props to what Dejanay Carrington was able to do. Like, I wonder if she was just extra, not necessarily amped, but like extra prepared for this one, considering like she got more of Kelsey Mitchell in that Fever series than she did with Caitlin Clark. And then going from Kelsey Mitchell and all that off-ball movement right to Kayla McBride is like a similar deal in terms of the usage there. But yeah, not a bad game for Kayla McBride, kind of quiet. More so quiet for Courtney. It's like, and just the scoring for her. And so just trying to find those pockets and pick and roll in particular is going to be interesting to track in that game too. I know she can get to that midi. But how often is she getting to it? What kind of pressure is she putting on the rim? I felt like it was a really good playmaking game for her. But they are going to need the blend of that playmaking and more of the higher volume scoring for her. And like I say this, I have these questions about Minnesota, what they're going to do. And like it was a 3-point game that went down to the wire. And if they're able to get a cleaner look on the last possession of the game, maybe that goes to overtime where the game extends, they're able to push in and stuff like that. So we could be looking at a different result. Like, I don't think, and I hope I haven't given off the impression that Minnesota's just out of it, because they certainly are. It was right there. I'm just really excited to see what this game two is going to look like. These are two fun teams, very versatile players at the top of East Scouting Report. I'm going to have a lot of fun with this one. Did you have any closing thoughts or questions on this game one?
No. Can't wait to see game two. It'll be very fun.
Okay, well then, very quickly on the box score front, 17, 10, and 9 with 3 steals for Alyssa Thomas. Was on triple-double watch in that first half, played all 20 minutes, had 9 points, 5 boards, 6 assists, and those 3 steals in that first half. 20 points for Marina Mabry, 13 points, 9 boards, 4 assists, 2 steals for Dejanay Carrington, 10 points, 11 rebounds, 5 assists, and a block for DeWanna Bonner. Again, only 6 points, 2 boards, and 2 assists for Bree Jones. For the Lynx, 19 points, 9 boards, 4 assists, 2 steals, and a block for Nafisa Collier. 17 points for Bridget Carlton and 2 steals. Kayla McBride with 12 points. Only went 1 of 5 from 3, so we'll keep an eye on that one. Courtney Williams, 8 points, only 2 of 10 inside the arc. Again, the mid-range jumper, her bread and butter. So we'll see if that bounces back in game 2. 4 boards, 4 assists, and a steal. 6 points, 8 boards, 4 assists, 2 steals, and 5 blocks for Alana Smith. A 7-stock game. And her second half in particular was really strong on the defensive end. So I wanted to give the props there. But 2 of 5 inside the arc, 0 of 4 from 3. So we'll see if that bounces back. I guess zooming out from the playoffs, just any general basketball thought or question or free throw or anything of the sort before we get out of here.
Nope.
All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. I guess circling back to media day very quickly, like seeing the picture of Chris Paul and Victor Wembanyama earnestly made me chuckle. That is one tall person in Victor Wembanyama, and Chris Paul in the Spurs uniform in general is going to take some getting used to, even though the Spurs are my career team. So that's fun. So I've gotten a little bit of practice, but now just seeing that in practice is going to be interesting. The Tyler Hero quote for however serious you want to take media day quotes, asked about, does he want to start, et cetera. He's like, I want to do whatever. I just want to do whatever it takes to win a championship. I'm going to let Spo handle that. I'm going to let Pat Riley handle that, et cetera. So I am curious to see if the Tyler Hero back to the bench button gets pressed at all, or if he's just kind of baked in as a starter. I think either is fine, but we'll see what that opens up if he's serious about that comment. The just general shout out Damian Lillard. You could find that one. I think that'll do it for me for right now. I'm sure we're going to get more media day fun and more NBA things as the week goes on. Again, waiting on final details on the Cat Julius Randle trade. So we'll update that when we get the information. But beyond that, thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast, you can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter if you haven't already. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties if you aren't doing that. Plenty of basketball, plenty of video games, plenty of wrestling, plenty of fun overall. It is free to create your profile, no shenanigans. The link is in the podcast description. So do that. Come hang with us. Come have some fun. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week. Bye.